You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor, Chief Executive of the RSA. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to this evening's event, which we're delighted to be running in partnership with Nesta. In the run-up to the election, we're pleased to collaborate on this discussion to reimagine the structure of government. At the RSA, we're looking at how new institutional models and methods of design and delivery can deliver change in public services. So this is a subject of great interest to us. Nesta has composed a letter detailing a range of proposals for implementation by the new or re-elected Prime Minister. Now, we're looking forward to hearing from Jeff Mulgan, Nesta's Chief Executive. He's going to provide an outline of the proposed transformative changes to how the centre of government works. And we have two brilliant respondents to Jeff's ideas. Lord Gus O'Donnell, former Cabinet Secretary and Head of the Civil Service, and Sue Cameron, columnist at the Daily Telegraph. So, without further ado, please welcome Jeff Mulgan.
Well, thanks very much, Matthew, and for hosting this tonight, and thank you all for coming to what, in some ways, is a rather arcane minority interest topic. We were in the midst of an election with frenzies of speculation about coalitions, about deals, about the shape of the next government. And in a few weeks' time, we'll have endless discussion about who should get which job and who's going up and who's going down. We almost never talk about what sort of lies one layer beneath that in terms of how government works, how it's structured, what its processes might be. And that may be because it's an incredibly boring topic, though the fact that you're in this room probably suggests that you think there may be some import to it. And in most fields of life, it's taken for granted that how you structure things is quite important to your chances of succeeding in getting things done. And really the premise for this letter, indeed this event, was actually how a government is structured probably will have a fair amount of impact on the likelihood of a Prime Minister being able to come back in 4 or 5 years' time having actually achieved what he, and it will be a he, I think, has promised rather than not. And at the very least, we should have a debate. We should be exploring the options and kicking the tyres on them and not only talking about the party arithmetic, the deals and so on. So in this letter, we set out, I'm going to go 1 minute each on the sort of four main areas of recommendation which we have set forth. The first is a very simple idea, which is that there is no law which says you have to have a cabinet of 22, 24, I think it's now closer to 30 ministers in attendance. And probably everyone in this room will know any committee of that size can't really function as a proper centre of deliberation. And what we've advocated instead is for a Prime Minister to clarify what are the 4 or 5 really important priorities for their government, and to put ministers in charge of marshalling the resources right across government to achieving those goals. They may be updating the infrastructure, transport, energy, telecoms and so on. It might be eliminating poverty. It might be boosting UK productivity. All of these tasks are by their nature multi-departmental ones, and we think it makes sense to have a political lead responsible for the totality of the task and its achievement, aligning budgets, legislation, communications to that end. And, as it were, the layer of departments feeding into that. This is very different from the super ministries proposals experimented with in a couple of times in British history. And it's very similar to what actually Juncker implemented in the European Commission in Brussels, which seems to be working rather well for the government of 500 million people. But, of course, saying anything is based on an idea in Brussels immediately probably rules it out for many people. But some version of that, some version of marshalling government resources aligned to priorities rather than to traditional silos of departments, I would say is a crucial first step for a Prime Minister. Secondly, we advocate dealing with the Treasury. We're in the very unusual position that both likely Prime Ministers have worked in the Treasury. The Treasury is full of some of the cleverest people in Britain, and the Treasury has seen off many past efforts at reform. But it is telling there is no country in the world which has copied the British system of having a Treasury which combines so many different functions, from budgetary control to economic policy to finance. And we argue for breaking these up. for putting budgetary control much more clearly under the Prime Minister and the Cabinet Office in an office of a budget of some form, and merging many of the economic functions into a revamped biz department, which would be a department for growth, and dealing with what's been a problem for many, many decades, which is the relative weakness of the UK's primary industry department relative to a treasury primarily focused on finance. Thirdly, we argue for a whole set of changes in how the centre of government should work, its use of things like data, its management of social media. A key point here is that we advocate much more explicit focus on experimentation and evidence in government as really a style of how a new government should work, rather than the classic British style where you determine a policy, you implement it at the scale of the whole of the UK at once, and then you spend several years unravelling it as it doesn't work. An incredibly inefficient way of doing policy. And luckily, in the last few weeks, we've seen for the first time, I think, ever, three political parties running for election committing themselves to experimentalism as a new approach to governance. Sadly, all three parties are in Finland, not in Britain. But we can at least copy Finland in the years to come, in this as in so many other things. And finally, we argue for changing some of the rhythms of government and how it communicates. Government is still dominated by the Queen's speech on legislation, by the budget process and so on. We think we should move to really a more basically modern approach of a government setting out in something more like a US presidential State of the Union address, setting out what it's trying to achieve, why, when and how, and not separating out legislation and spending. And that some other detailed reforms, in particular to the Office of Budget Responsibility, could reinforce that by reporting not just on, as it were, the fiscal position of government, but also how spending decisions in 1 year are likely to impact on the budget position in 10, 20, 30 years' time. So we can have a proper assessment of spending choices as between, let's say, preventive healthcare and curative healthcare, education and welfare, business subsidies, and so on. We use these methods for investment in airports and roads. It's amazing in some ways that government still hasn't updated its methods of thinking about money in terms of spending on people, even though these dominate government budgets today. And as a result, most of the debates about things like deficit reduction are deeply distorted because the very categories are really sort of mid-20th century ones rather than 21st century ones. The time for all these things to happen is the moment just after an election when a prime minister has the mandate, the freedom, doesn't have too many fragile egos to bruise by changing things. And our hope would be that a newly elected or re-elected prime minister would use that moment to overhaul how government works. Sadly, this is very rare in British history. And I think one of the reasons is that so few of our leaders actually have that much experience of running things. We're not like many other countries where politicians have often run a city or a region or a state before they get to a national level and therefore have a feel for how systems work. They don't confuse the soundbite for the strategy, the press release for the action. And perhaps our biggest risk after May the 7th is of prime ministers still in that, as it were, communications-led view of government rather than thinking through what's the underlying wiring of government, which will, as I said at the beginning, best guarantee that when they come back in 4 or 5 years' time, they've actually achieved the things which they promise. Thank you.
Great. Now, so Gus has been asked to speak for 6 or 7 minutes. He warned me before that he's got a half an hour speech. But you need to remember, Gus, that I worked in Number 10 when you were in a more elevated position for me. I've never been able to exercise authority over you, and tonight may be my first chance. So you might want to stick closer to the designated time.
So, if you thought the period of cuts was over, we know already they're going strong. Right, very quickly, on Jeff's key ideas about super ministers, I would say most prime ministers have actually functioned with a group of senior ministers around them, sometimes called the A-team, if you go back through history. And I think it's quite a good idea for them to have a small, tight-knit group, which actually might put a bit of formality around. It is certainly true. When I was cabinet secretary, we were exploring how to extend the cabinet room, because every time there was kind of, you know, a new minister attending cabinet, because you didn't want to not have them as cabinet ministers. So they got the consolation prize and the whole thing got bigger. So I think they're fine as long as they stick with their departments. The fact that they are leading these key priorities that you put forward, I think, is brilliant, because it gets to the point that I think governments are very weak at, which is actually stating that they have three or four key priorities. And I think the ones you've put forward are interesting, but you'd like to have a prime minister, and I'd like to have a prime minister say, here are the five things I really want to achieve. And I'll come back to what they might be for both of them. So I think that's good. As a former permanent secretary of the Treasury, you'll forgive me for not wanting to abolish the Treasury. It's a complicated world, and getting the relationship right between Number 10 and the Treasury is hugely important, and that would cover an hour as to how to do that. But I completely understand where you're coming from, Jeff, and I have grappled with this. As soon as you start taking the growth stuff out of the Treasury still wins, and the growth stuff disappears. So it was to try and give it some oomph that it came into the Treasury, and I think Biz has always struggled to be as effective as Treasury. Therefore, if you move it out, I think you lose quite a lot.
Can I just interrupt?
Yeah, yeah.
Wasn't it part of the secret 2005 plan, the breakup of the Treasury?
Yes.
This was a secret plan concocted by Tony Blair and people around him, based upon kind of responding to the threat of Gordon Brown, which was then ripped up as a consequence of Tony Blair saying that Gordon Brown was his successor during the election campaign. I remember it being ripped up. It was ripped up in front of me the day after the election. So anyway, it has been around
a while. It has been around. And it was a kind of OMB-style plan. Not that I'm completely... well, anyway, yes, so it was. OK. I'm very strongly in favour of the points that Jeff made about skills and capabilities that are in the letter. I think that's hugely important. But if I can, I'd like to come to the... So if I'm Cabinet Secretary, there are two variants, as Jeff made out. So let's assume each variant. So I'm Cabinet Secretary. David Cameron's come back. Congratulations, Prime Minister. You've done an amazing thing. You've won. Whereas, actually, only 17 days before the election, the betting markets were saying that Ed Miliband was the favourite to be the next Prime Minister. So you've turned that around. That's brilliant. Two big issues for you. Huge issues for you. One is the EU referendum that you're committed to, and the second is, I'll come back to the State of the Union, but in this case I'm talking about the United Kingdom. On the referendum issue, you have a really world-class team, secretariat, that handle EU issues. They are brilliant at coordinating our position across the different departments and putting it across in Brussels. However, that's what they do. They do not look outwards. They do not communicate with the public particularly, and they will have this extra tension of dealing with Scotland and managing our position in Europe, where the individual nations might feel that they want us to change the way we do it. So you've got to revamp your EU secretariat and make it more outward-facing and think clearly about this EU referendum. Because, Prime Minister, since this is your last term, as you have informed us... Your history is going to look at two things you do. That's the first one. The second is the union. Since you won, you will have observed Nicola Sturgeon saying, reminding people of Scotland that the reason for independence was that you get the government you vote for. Scotland has voted massively SNP, and they've got you. That's going to be an issue. And by the way, you and all the party leaders, whoever wins the next election, the number one piece of legislation is going to be about devolution. It's going to be implementing all the Smith reforms. So if it's you, David Cameron, if it's Ed Miliband, you are going to have, before Parliament, a massive amount of devolution to Scotland to put through, and the St David's Agreement and the Stormont Agreement. So there's lots of things happening. So you'll need to beef up your devolution and constitution unit. There are legitimacy questions that have arisen from this election because the relationship between votes and seats is so... how shall I put this? Unusual, non-linear. Therefore, you're going to have to handle that as well. Now, if That's my spiel for David Cameron. If it were Ed Miliband coming in, I'd say first and foremost, congratulations. It's a complicated world, your prime ministership, and you're going to have to deal with Parliament rather carefully because you do have a very large number of SNP MPs that we've never had before. And therefore, you're going to have to improve from the centre your ability to manage Parliament and to deal with individual MPs because there'll be some tight votes. Secondly, we probably don't want to legislate any more than we have to. Therefore, it will be good to find non-legislative means. Fortunately, you've got Jeff and the RSA all talking about different ways of doing things, experimenting, behavioural ideas, trialling. Those things, I think, will be far more important rather than legislating for, you know, bans or new regulations. So I think there's an upside to this. So I think that's the first thing. Secondly, your Labour predecessor had some really good ideas which could come back. I would combine the policy and delivery units into one unit at the centre. I think that's a really good idea. There was a chap called Jeff Mulgan who was a policy unit head. And also, in those days, your 2 days, we had some strategy. And I think it's really important to have a big strategy arm that could help you with these five priorities. And I would like that. But I think it has to be quasi-independent. I think you have to have it at arm's length. Otherwise, everything that John Burt thinks about legalising drugs or whatever it happens to be becomes a front-page story. And I think you need to have it, a bit like the French, Pisani-Ferry manages to be able to be somewhat independent and get out there and talk about these things and have a grown-up debate rather than then be leaks of separate issues. So those are the things I do. I'd say, with regard to the Treasury, whoever you are, do a five-year plan. You've got a five-year fixed-term Parliaments Act. Let's kind of, and lots of people thinking you won't last 5 years, so let's really show them five-year plan, long-term planning, get your strategic objectives sorted out. Your strategy unit will help with that. And then you can implement them. You will have some issues with the Treasury, I would foresee, and we need to find a way of managing those. And you're probably not going to listen to Jeff and abolish the Treasury. Therefore, we need to work very hard on finding good ways of Number 10 and the Treasury working together in a way that allows you, Prime Minister, to have a view about the economy without the Treasury thinking that it's this is illegitimate. There you go.
Thank you very much. Can I just before I turn to you, Sue, just one thing, because I'm not sure you respond. Kind of Jeff's point about, as it were, a kind of office of policy responsibility, in a sense, a kind of more independent voice that can explore what the consequences are of proposed changes. Is that an idea which attracts you? Do you think it's naive, given the political nature?
I think it's a fantastic idea. I called it the Office of Taxpayer Responsibility. So I completely agree with it. And I would say what you need to do is have something which can cast an eye over policies to say, is this deliverable? Will it achieve the outcomes you want?
And that too would have to be semi-independent.
And I'd have that as semi-independent. It might be a creature of Parliament, and it would help you with the nonsense. We could get rid of this nonsense about the PAC grandstanding when things have gone wrong. Let's, for God's sake, let them do something useful by actually analysing things at the start.
Great. Thank you very much. Sue.
Well, one of the things that's in the letter, it says that the centre, a better organised centre, should project power and control across the rest of government. And I rather feel that this is a bit of a fundamental flaw in the whole series of suggestions, because Number 10 shouldn't necessarily be about controlling everyone else. It should be about better outcomes, about better government. And I can't help feeling that part of the inspiration for it comes from the TBGB saga, the endless wars between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's Treasury that characterises sort of the later years at any rate. Of course, if the Prime Minister and the Chancellor get on badly, it's best if you can get rid of one of them. But I don't think you need an upheaval in Whitehall. And I take the point that you want super ministers, not super ministries, But it does seem to me that if you're going to have super ministers who are really controlling big chunks of government or having an overview, deciding all the major schemes in it, then that is going to involve changes rather at a rather lower level, and you will end up with sort of semi-super ministries, if nothing else. And one of the problems of doing that is that it takes everybody's eyes off the ball. They all start worrying about who's in charge, what's the mission statement, and even some of them will be thinking, do I have to reapply for my own job and where do I sit? I think this would certainly be one of the things with the splitting up the Treasury. When the Department of Economic Affairs was set up in the 1960s, which I think was the last time there was a serious effort to disempower the Treasury, George Brown, the Secretary of State, I think life must have been rather fun under George Brown because he was absolutely rat-arsed for a lot of the time. But he arrived to find that he was the only one who had a chair, and the handful of officials he'd been given all had to sit on the floor like Buddhas. And Sir Samuel Britton, who'd been drafted in, Sam, quite illegally and against the rules, kept a diary. And the opening entry was, gloomy toilet with no soap or towel. No telephone directories. No tea. This was a privilege of the messengers, but there were no messengers on our corridor. Found cupboard in my room which wouldn't open. Told about stringent security precautions, but there was no security cupboard in my room. Now, I think that under the sort of blueprint or the recommendations that you've come up with, I think one of the first things that would happen, I'm afraid, is that what an awful lot of people in Whitehall, both politicians and civil servants, would be focusing on would be a new round of turf wars between the deputy prime ministers. I know you only want a small number of them, or the super ministers, whatever you want to call them, between the deputy prime ministers, between the deputy prime ministers and their secretaries of state, and between them and perhaps and the junior ministers. And I do think in particular, I know you might not use the title, but a deputy prime minister tends to be a big title for someone with only minimal power. I mean, look at Nick Clegg. Nick Clegg's been Deputy Prime Minister. As far as I'm aware, he couldn't tell Eric Pickles or Michael Gove what to do or what their plan ought to be. And even John Prescott, who was, I think, in some ways a very effective, but that came from his own sort of political nous. It was very much a personal thing. And I think that one of the weaknesses, and maybe I'm being unfair here, but that some of the sort of the reorganisation, the restructuring, it doesn't seem to take as its starting point some specific policies. And I think it would be a lot more persuasive if it did. Of course, we need to find ways to tackle cross-cutting issues, social care and health, drugs, immigration. But it's all a bit vague. I think it would be much more persuasive if you could say, if in order to implement this particular policy or set of little group of policies, it can only be done if we make changes in the way that Whitehall functions. And I think there is a real risk that some of it could make things worse. I mean, apart from anything else, government, which I think a lot of the public doesn't realise, is just so big and so complicated. I mean, the Ministry of Defence, I think, is as bigger than a lot of FTSE 100 companies. It's bigger than Shell. And to put a minister in charge of the whole of the Ministry of Defence, plus I think you're going to have the FCO and DFID and call it international relations, I mean, it just seems to be to me to be far, far too huge. Something would fall out. And I think there's a suggestion to put one minister in charge of the whole of welfare. Well, the DWP's budget is £178 billion, and you want him then to do redistribution and social exclusion and call it an equalities ministry. Well, sounds, I'm afraid, like political posturing. We all believe in equality, don't we? Well, we do, but would it get us any nearer to achieving that? And there is also a huge pressure on the ministers themselves. I mean, they are all too human, don't we know it. When they tried to put social security and health together, well, indeed they did, and John Moore, poor man, who was the minister in charge, had a nervous breakdown as a result. And as for the suggestion that this would have the added benefit of shrinking the cabinet, of course you're absolutely right. There's no way to run a government. You couldn't run a decent mother's meeting with that many people that go now. But surely, if you really just want fewer of them to go to cabinet, you just tell them they can't come. You tell the spads, the people around the wall, the ministers who've got the right to come, just say, no, you can't come. And I don't believe either that we need a State of the Union address. I think the whole argument about getting prime ministers and governments to lay out their priorities is a really, really good one. But the prime minister, whoever he or she is, already has. We're not America. We're not. We don't have a president. And prime ministers have already got plenty of opportunity to lay out what their priorities are going to be. And indeed, which I do think is a good idea, to link them very closely to what's going to be done with the spending arrangements rather than... There's an awful lot of billions, I know it's election time, being flung around without very much argument about where the money's coming from. I think that one of the... Of course, I think we need, I think most people do, we need a more strategic role for the centre. I heard somebody, it might have been Charlie Faulkner, saying you need somebody at the centre that would stop the Andrew Lansley health bill even getting off the drawing board. And I think that's absolutely right. And as Gus said, one of the things they're going to have to face is going to be constitutional change, which is becoming increasingly urgent following the election campaign. But I think that instead of projecting all the time more power from Downing Street, what's needed perhaps is more freedom for those on the ground to develop some of their own solutions. There have been a lot of good ideas, some bad ones, but a lot of good ideas in local government as they have struggled to deal with the cuts that have really hit them because they're not protected, unlike health and a few other UK-wide departments. Labour councils are taking part in George Osborne's Northern Powerhouse project. And the Department of Health, for instance, has a Connect programme on the ground which links up with social services and other services. I went to see it in Ipswich last year. And it's really, really good. And it's something they're doing themselves off their own bat, and it's really working. And even abroad, I mean, in Afghanistan, the military and the Foreign Office and DFID all work together really well, and they haven't needed a super minister to get them to do it in any of these cases. As for the cabinet, which I do think has got to be smaller, I think that one of the things you should do is go for evolution and build on what we've already got. The Quad seems to be working rather well, and it has more people there usually than four. Why not get a new government to do something like that and build on it? But I would, in thinking about change, don't ever forget the words of Sir Humphrey Appleby, who said, it's axiomatic in government that hornets' nests should be left unstirred, cans of worms should remain unopened, cats should not be set among pigeons, and ministers should resolutely turn their backs to the music. Sometimes it's best to go slowly.
Thank you, Sue. So I'm going to ask a couple of questions before I open it up, but I have to give Jeff an opportunity. I mean, Sue didn't seem to agree with much that you said, but don't rebut every one of her points, but just there's not particular one particular thing that she said which you want to kind of respond to, Jeff, because she's...
Well, maybe there's a general point. There are 200-plus national governments in the world, all of which grapple with exactly the same issues we're talking about here. And at the very least, our debate should not be parochial. We should look whether we can learn from them, and indeed whether we can learn from Scotland, which has done many of the things we describe in this letter rather better than Westminster. I was surprised at you standing up for the Queen's speech and the budget as the primary times when government expresses what it's trying to do. One through the monarch, only focused on legislation, one through the Chancellor only focused on money. I cannot believe any government starting from scratch would think that was a sensible thing to do, and I'm not aware of any government around the world which does that. As I mentioned, we have a peculiar treasury for historical reasons. Again, none of the other 200 governments around the world has thought our model is such a brilliant one, they should copy it. They've gone for models much closer to what we describe. And therefore, I think the onus of proof is, as it were, on the defenders of a strange status quo, not the advocates for fairly mainstream reform. The same applies to proposals on super ministers, whatever you want to call them. Again, this is not that unusual in many other places, from Scotland to Scandinavia. Indeed, if you look at the best ranked governments worldwide, by the World Bank and others, many of them use methods like this. They certainly don't work if they're super ministries, like the DHSS, which does lead to nervous breakdowns, because they're trying to run everything. But having senior politicians focused on the strategic issues which really matter on big priorities seems to work better than having them sort of trapped in their departmental silos. I also really disagree with what you said about the Foreign Office and MOD and DFID. There may be a few occasions when they do work well, but in many countries around the world, and this isn't particularly a criticism of those departments, Britain has three different strategies. It has a military strategy, an FCO strategy, and a DFID strategy, and often they are at loggerheads. So all we're proposing is that someone has the job of making sure there is some coherence between these, whether it's in how we act in Pakistan or Bangladesh or Algeria or Brazil. And again, I think the onus of proof is on those who think this is a mad idea to have such alignment and coordination, not on on the side that we're arguing for. So there are deep instincts in British government of small-c conservatism. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. All your quotes from Sir Humphrey are very familiar and very normal in the civil service. And I would not advocate structural reform for the sake of it. Indeed, often ministers try to change structures as a displacement activity from dealing with the real things. And I'm a person who advocated a moratorium on NHS restructuring for 10 years, which was overturned by my boss, Tony Blair, who didn't think, but there are some times you do need to change structures in order to get better results. And that sort of sceptical small-c conservatism, which leads to changing nothing, I think gives us rather less effective government than we deserve.
Can I ask a very specific question of you, Gus, and then a question of the whole panel? So, why do you think that, generally speaking, whatever people's views are about what reforms are necessary, that this agenda is not grasped early on by new prime ministers, and that there seems to be such an institutional memory? I think it's pretty widely accepted now that one of David Cameron's mistakes on becoming prime minister was not to understand the need for a strong number 10, something which he gradually learnt as the years went on. I think he himself has kind of admitted this. How was it, in a sense, that he was able to come into Downing Street with all that institutional memory and think that he didn't really need much power in number 10? What is there we can do to prepare incoming prime ministers better for the fact that they do need, as Jeff said, whatever they do, to do this stuff early on?
And I think if you were to look at the manifestos and say, how many of them have got any of these ideas in there? And the answer is none, as far as I can see. And that's the problem, really. If you want to come in on day one and make big changes, you risk doing what Jeff is absolutely against on the policy side, which is just, hey, you know, let's do it. Where's the evidence? Where's the experimentation? Where, you know, is it right or not? So I would say, if you want this to happen, actually, the debate should happen now. We should think about it. We should put out all the different... use the international evidence that Jeff has suggested for what works well in different countries. You know, give it to one of our What Works centres. Get them to come up with some plans which can be discussed and debated, which we could then implement in due course when we've really thought hard about how to do it. What you don't want is a Prime Minister coming in with a secret plan that hasn't actually had any debate, which is, you know, may or may not be a good idea. So I would quite like it to be proper thinking in advance, and this would fit in with the whole idea of, surprise, surprise, can't we train MPs? Can't we give people the chance? As, you know, Jackie Smith, on going into the Home Office, said, you know, if I do this job well, it's by luck, because, you know, it's a huge job. I mean, why can't we
just own up to the fact that this is massive and you should have a lot of preparation for it, and we should prepare for the machinery of government changes. And actually, that's why I kind of, Jeff's point about the Treasury, I feel quite nervous about, because I do want to actually look at the evidence around. I am very aware that Scotland's way of reorganising their government when they did it has proved to be very effective. And I think there may well be better ways of doing this. I just don't want to jump to something which is a kind of knee-jerk reaction of, oh, the Treasury's bad because they keep saying no. Well, actually, someone's got to say no. There's all those other people around that huge cabinet table who all their careers depend on spending lots. So you do need a strong Treasury, I'm afraid.
That answer, Gus, prompts me for the question that I wanted to ask you all, which is, I'm really interested in this kind of softer side of stuff, you know, not to do with kind of restructuring, although I think it's very interesting stuff in what you're arguing, Jeff. But, you know, things like induction of ministers, things like some kind of work to recognise that you might use coaches, facilitators, people like this. The reason cabinet committees don't work is because there's no one actually responsible for making them work as groups of people collaborating together, you know. And even, it seems to me, one of the things that is kind of jarring about this, and I understand that politics is different from management and from administration, but, you know, in a modern organisation, if I was to say in the RSA, I want to promote somebody, not because they're any good, but because they're a mate of mine and because they're loyal to me, my HR department would, I mean, they'd expose me. They'd go to the trustee board and they'd say, this bloke's lost control, you need to get rid of him. So, you know, the fact that there is no serious objective account of whether ministers are any good and whether or not their promotion ought to be related to their performance or any kind of assessment of their performance, this kind of ordinary stuff that is accepted as good management and good personnel management in the rest of the world is absent. And you and I, you remember, Gus, when we were talking about the capability reviews, the thing I said that was missing in the capability reviews that were done in Whitehall departments was looking at the relationship between politicians and senior civil servants, which for me was always the most problematic thing, and between SPADs and ministers and all of that. So, starting with you, Jeff, why did you not look at that kind of softer side of things as well in your proposals for change?
I agree with everything you said, and maybe I'm just a bit bruised from having been part of several attempts to introduce training for ministers, which was introduced in the 90s. Proposals for fairly elementary HR processes for ministers, always rejected by the top politicians and prime ministers. This is probably not I'm going to cite an example from another country which may undermine my point. I quite often lecture at the China Executive Leadership Academy, which teaches ministers, mayors, governors in China. Pretty much by law, you have to do about 2 to 3 weeks residential training each year if you have those jobs of seniority. It's just assumed there has to be a lot of learning to be any good at running, you know, a complex department. They have an organisation committee in the Communist Party which then does the appraisals and keeps the files, often obviously for ideological reasons, not just for human development. But the democracies could learn a little bit, just a tiny bit, from how China does this. Because, as Matthew says, almost nothing of the best of HR practice of the last probably two generations has been incorporated into the political side of government here, as far as I'm aware.
So, do you think that's a bonkers idea?
Basically, yes.
Okay. I kind of thought you might.
I think the idea of giving ministers some training is a very, very good one. I mean, they desperately need it. And the sort of there have been attempts to do it, but they've come to nothing. But I'm afraid the sort of setup, you know, HR, etc., it just isn't workable, it seems to me, and isn't going to be acceptable, not least to the politicians, in a democracy. And I'm not sure that, I'm sure the RSA is wonderful, but I'm not sure that in business and industry, often very successful chief executives are also very autocratic, and they do put their mates in jobs. I mean, they may be good, but they decide who they want, very much in the same way that the Prime Minister decides who he or she wants in their cabinet. I think that it isn't going to be the answer to give them more training. And I'd have thought much more important, which, to be fair to him, Cameron has tried to do, is to keep them, as long as they're reasonably competent, keep them in the same job for a reasonably long period and not have cabinet reshuffles every year or every 18 months just for the sake of sending out political signals. And in politics, personalities, etc., really matter. And one of the reasons why I think that the super ministers would have difficulties is that the turf wars would just go and the discussions would just go one level down. And I think it's much better that debate about what should happen in the MOD or what should happen in DFID or what should happen in local government should be, as part of the democratic process, there should be a forum. One reason why cabinet needs to be changed a bit, or the central decision-making body, there should be a forum where you can have those debates and not say, well, if we've got one man in charge of a great, or woman in charge of a great chunk of it, it'll all be much easier. If it is, it'll just either suppress it or you will sort of have a kind of Stasi-type minister.
Happen?
I think it should happen in cabinet committees is where it happens at present. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think that's somewhere where it could happen. But you need groups of ministers who can discuss, you know, openly and actually have a proper debate, not one person deciding a great area of policy.
Just come in on this. But also, one other last thing before we open up from you, which is, what about, I mean, a word that nobody has mentioned is coalition. So I'm just, final point for you to add on to your contribution to this conversation is, what would we do differently if there's going to be, what would you do differently if there was going to be another coalition government in contrast to what has been happened in the last 5 years?
Okay. The first point, though, I kind of, we'd all love to have better trained ministers, and I think that debate has to happen amongst the ministers. You've got to have MPs deciding that there's some process, because we've been saying it. I remember, Jeff, do you remember the there was a really modest attempt, which was letters. We were going to give appointment letters to ministers and we're actually going to give them some objectives, right? Surprise. Do you remember? Do you remember that? We all wrote them.
Yeah, yeah.
We all did them. Didn't last very long. It's just kind of even modest things have the political system really doesn't like them. And I think Sue's picked up on that very much. So we do, there is a really strong culture change. Now, one of the ways I think we can change the culture, and a couple of people mentioned cabinet committees. Actually, I think we've got that fundamentally wrong, the more I've thought about this. Because in a standard cabinet committee, you have a number of ministers, all from different departments, sit down. They've all got their brief prepared by their civil servants and they argue it through. I think this is madness, right? And the committee that actually works best is the National Security Committee. And Gordon Brown experimented with the National Economic Committee. And the thing that's different about those committees is they are, you take the National Security Committee, you have the relevant ministers. They're very much in charge. They're going to make the final decisions. But you also have the heads of the defence forces. You have the heads of the intelligence agencies. So you have the senior officials and the ministers all in one room together. How simple is that? Now, so what I want to do is, building on your idea, let's say you've got your ministers in charge of your five key priorities. So for each one, we have a committee like that, which has the key ministers from different departments, led by your super minister, if you like, and the key officials who are going to deliver this. They might be at different levels in different places. And surprise, surprise, something we did in the National Economic Committee was some people from outside, actually experts in the subject. Can you believe that? God, this is radical. I've discovered you can be incredibly radical when you leave.
Was this before or after the credit crunch?
This was, yeah. But so I think that, actually, that culture change would start to see things differently. And I think ministers would, in that process of chairing those committees, actually learn quite a lot as well.
Can I just very, very briefly, then I'm going to take one.
I strongly agree with that. And one of the flippant comments that I once made about government is most of the really important decisions are made with no one in the room who knows what they're talking about. And that includes your quads and others. There are exceptions like defence. Health increasingly is an exception where you have genuinely knowledgeable people around the table, like chief medical officers and so on. But I think the principle that every decision-making body should ensure that in the room, at the moment the key decisions are made, there actually is depth of expertise, not someone reading a brief who's only been in their post for a month or two or a year or two, would be a radical but achievable change.
Great.
So you asked about coalition and I didn't answer.
Do you want me to pass on?
Briefly.
briefly, what we've learned.
What would you do differently?
What would I do differently? Well, you mentioned one of the things about a prime minister coming in wanting a very slim number 10. So if you have the prime minister has a slim number 10, the deputy prime minister, by definition, has to have an incredibly slim backup, too small, in my view. I did try to say, actually, you know, the role of prime minister has got so much bigger, EU councils and all the rest of it, that they should be bigger. And I would say, actually, from the start, if you're having a coalition, let's make it work. Let's sort out how you're going to solve the problem of departments where you can't coalitionise via ministers because you haven't got a minister there. And remember, if the projections are anything to go by, if you've got a coalition with the Lib Dems, this problem's much, much bigger this time because they're half the size, right? So they'll have half as many ministers if they do the negotiations on a pro rata basis. So it's a much, much bigger problem. You've got to get that right. You've got to find a way of coalitionising in a world where the small party really is small.
OK, I'm going to take a whole variety of points. If you can keep them brief, and I'll bring the panel in right at the end. So let's take this cluster of three here to start off with.
My name is Ken Rushton. I used to work in big business. When a large company does an organisation review, the place it starts is looking at the role and responsibilities of the board. And I was wondering why you haven't got any recommendations about the role and responsibilities of the cabinet. Because surely it should start there and then trickle down.
Hi, my name's Pat Kane. Depending on how the numbers fall, of course, there's actually the word that's in your letter a lot is legitimation. How do you find legitimation for a centralised government? Now, if quite a lot of the parties in a possible assemblable majority are calling themselves progressives, then there is a possibility that you can actually look at much. If you're talking about the Louis Brandeis sense of laboratories of democracy, well, you have three laboratories of democracy. They're called Northern Ireland, Wales and Scotland. So you already have a kind of policy diversity built into the concept of a progressive majority, but the centre will have to be, in a sense, patient, broad-thinking, genuinely pluralist, thinking about the island from top to toe and from left to right, because there is actually a possibility for a lot of energy to come in to centralised Westminster Whitehall government from the peripheries, from the regions, from the small nations. And it really is about generosity of spirit as much as it is about excellently fashioned and crafted structures, I think.
Great, lovely point. Yep, I'm here.
Thank you. Keith Best. I want to come back to something to which both Matthew and Gus adverted to briefly. I know business and government are not analogous, and there are very many different differences, but having been in Parliament and then run three national charities after that, there is one very, very big difference, and that is if I was not devising with my board a strategic plan with key performance indicators attached to it, by which I and the board were going to be measured, then we would be actually going nowhere. Now, I'm not suggesting that manifestos are the substitute for that, but how would you feel about if a government, on coming into office, had to set out a strategic plan for, now we've got the five-year parliaments, for that 5 years, with the key performance measurements on which it was prepared to be judged as to whether it was performing that or not, and then that would also lead to far greater accountability for ministers in charge of departments, and you would then see with more transparency whether they were being sacked for whimsical reasons or whether they were being sacked because they just weren't producing the goods.
Thank you. I think, and Gus can confirm this, I think that the departments did actually do that in 2010. I think they were required to write five-year strategies, and they sent them in. I remember printing them all out, a great part of them. I don't know what happened to them subsequently, but... yes.
Thank you. Mohammed Birmadani. If the Conservative return to the office, will of course have a referendum, but if they don't have a majority, they will find it very hard to have a... to organize a referendum on the European Union. And my discussion with the European ministers, they don't really believe that a referendum will take place. Right. So what's your view?
Will the referendum take place? That's an interesting question. I think it depends who wins. Good. A woman at last.
Thank you very much. My name is Georgina Pattinson. Thank you for a fascinating discussion.
What really caught my eye was that the UK government has, and you say, a memory like a sieve. It sounds as though we need a sort of office for history lessons as much as anything else. Why is Whitehall so very bad at learning lessons from the past? Is it a fear of failure, or is it just that documents are sealed, never to be opened again?
Very good. And any other last comments before I bring the panel back in? Yeah, right at the back of the room.
Thanks very much. Ian Tuckett. The problem with super ministries is that it perpetuates the idea that you can decide at the centre such and such needs to happen, and somehow you pull a lever and it's going to happen. Whereas the reality is you actually have to engage people across the country. And as Gus has indicated, at a time of devolution, you know, this becomes quite an issue. And if we want to have, you know, England versus Scotland, you know, a sort of rugger match, this is a pretty poor model. And I would have thought it would be much better to move to a regional thing where the real talent at the centre of government is to coordinate and facilitate the working together of the different regions.
Great. I'm really glad that question was asked at the end, because all the manifestos are committed to going down the route that the RSA and other organisations laid out last year in relation to greater devolution to cities and city regions. None of you have really talked about the implications of that for the centre, so I'd be interested if you could pick that up. So you can't answer all those points, but just pick up a couple if you don't mind.
Well, just starting with the last one first, I do agree that the centre of government should play a much greater role, as I said, in giving freedom to people who are more on the ground, and the role of the centre should be partly to regulate, partly to have oversight and to coordinate. But I think there should be much, much more room for local experimentation. And I think we're beginning to see this, the sort of the Northern Powerhouse idea. I'm not in favour, I don't know if that's what anybody means, but I'm not in favour of, you know, the sort of the idea that they had at one point. Prescott was very keen on a regional assembly or anything like that. I think that you need to sort of keep health and all the other areas, but let people locally, on a much, much smaller level, decide what they want to do, and then report back, and perhaps one of the roles of the centre should be to share good ideas. And I think also to sometimes to have give much more local accountability. The difficulty is that you get postcode lotteries, people complaining that if only I lived over the county border, I'd have a much better deal. But I think that is where the centre can take an overarching view and say, that isn't working, but that is, why don't you do it like that?
One more point.
Oh, the government has to have a strategic plan. Yes, the like business does. I think that's a good idea in principle, but one of the difficulties of it is that in politics you do get the unexpected happening all the time in a way that isn't quite the same in business. You know, it's sort of events, dear boy, events. And the other thing is that you will get ministers changed to some extent, at any rate, and you will get people wanting with different ideas who will want to change the what they're wanting to do. And in business, you know that you have to make a profit, and that's always part of your motivation, however good a company you are, whereas sometimes, well, all the time in government, you have rather different long-term objectives.
Gus, it's all fascinating, but pick a couple of points.
Can I pick up what Pat said about legitimacy and tie that in with Ian's point? Because I think you're absolutely right, that, and it fits with this strategic plan. The way I would do things is I get the government, I give them 6 months on coming in, don't rush this, let's get our strategic plan, a bit like our spending review, and we're going to announce the money and the allocation of it, we're going to announce these five big things, let's say, and that's our strategic plan about the future. But then comes the second bit. So the central has done its role then. And what they tend then to do, and I think actually some of these people have done it quite a lot, was tell you how. And actually that's where I think all we need to do then is engage. We engage with local groups. We engage with nations. We think about very different ways of doing it. And I think we'd all say, that's quite good. Let's experiment. Let's think about different ways. Because if you do that, you get ownership of it. As opposed to if you've said, here we're going to improve the health service and here's how. We're going to have this restructuring, right? And then once you've done that, we do need a delivery function. So it's a kind of future engaged deliver I'd go for. And a strategic plan, you know, in 6 months, I think I'd use the Kevin Keegan phrase, if people remember what Kevin Keegan said. I'd love it. I'd love it. It would be brilliant. And it would just give us a lot of clarity. Those who don't understand Manchester United and Newcastle won't have got that last phrase. I apologise.
Ended as well. So Jeff, the final word goes to you. Actually, I have to say, I think a new idea has emerged this evening, which I think is a very good idea. I think there should be an independent government historian. Whenever government proposes anything, they are allowed to publish a précis of what has happened the previous times government has tried to do this. Which should be in the, I think it would be incredibly powerful. It should be in the public domain. This is a great new idea, so thank you for that. Jeff, over to you.
Well, just two final comments. I mean, the first is that if you think of super ministers as sort of Stalin-like figures pulling a lever and fixing things, then they are bound to fail, whatever the topic area we're talking about. In my mind, if you were the super minister for infrastructure, a lot of your job is actually persuasion and coordination within national government. Even more of your job is actually helping to work with local government and other entities around the kingdom. I began my career in local government, so I sort of take that for granted. And I think sort of over top-down command and control models, I mean, it's obvious those don't work, but that's not an excuse for having incompetence and ineffectiveness at the top. Now, part of their job, again, for the same reason, will be to organise the memory. I mean, after a few years in government, when I found myself again and again at meetings where I was the only person who'd been at the same meeting 6-7 years before, I had become the memory. I knew there was something going wrong, and there was nowhere to find the memory. And anyway, there's a whole set of issues around there. The What Works centres are a major advance in organising a collective memory across government, and it's really to the credit of this current, just departing government, that they back that so far. And I would actually agree with what you said about strategic plans. And these are fairly normal at many state level in the US or in Australia. Some of the best North European countries do, as a matter of course, try and set out more systematically what are we trying to achieve, often with quantitative numbers. Events happen, of course they happen, and then you describe and you think through how you're adjusting to them. And I just think this is sort of normal, fairly mainstream good governance now, but it does require some capability to do it. It doesn't happen automatically. And finally, on Pat's point, we actually now employ, through the Alliance for Useful Evidence, people in Belfast, Edinburgh and Cardiff, helping to share good policy experiments and evidence across the devolved administrations. I still think it's amazing how poor the United Kingdom is at doing that. And a very good symptom of that is really what Gus said about Scotland. Scotland has been through a whole series of really rather sensible governance innovations in the last dozen years, most of which have worked well, very admired across the world. I have literally never read a single piece in the London media, even describing them, let alone assessing them, never heard of a meeting in London discussing what could we learn from Cardiff, Edinburgh or Belfast. It simply never happens. And so when Nicola Sturgeon suddenly appears, it's as if she's sort of come from nowhere in the bizarre election campaign we're in. We've got to just get better, exactly as you say, at a more horizontal and humble learning from each other. We do have laboratories of government now in our United Kingdom in a way we didn't 20 years ago. Let's make the most of it.
So perhaps we should say to Nicola that rather than the Scotland separation from Britain, Scotland should just take over Britain and run it, because it's obviously so much more... Yeah, well, that may well be the answer. OK, now, we're getting into some slight controversy there. OK, thank you for your... I'm sorry we've run out of time. Thank you for your questions. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your questions. Just remains for me to ask you to thank Sue and Gus and Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.